The following program is brought to you with support from the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at American University. This is Latin Pulse, a weekly analysis of news and public affairs in Latin America, brought to you through the cooperation of the School of Communications at Webster University, the global university headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri, and Link TV. And now, here's host Rick Rockwell.
Bienvenidos and welcome to Latin Pulse. This week, we're coming to you from San Jose, Costa Rica. We'll be hearing about the economic crisis facing Costa Rican media, and more about another crisis, the problem of unaccompanied migrant children trying to cross the U.S. border with Mexico. And just a note, we're coming to you from a hotel on the Pan American Highway, so you may be able to hear Costa Rica's busy capital in the background. But first, Gabriela Canchola is here with our weekly review of news from around Latin America.
Pope Francis moved forcefully against child abuse in Latin America this week. He ordered the house arrest in the Vatican of one former Polish archbishop accused of sexually abusing young boys in the Dominican Republic. He also fired a bishop in Paraguay, saying the bishop helped cover up sexual abuse by a priest. Pope Francis promises a zero-tolerance policy regarding sexual abuse. Former Mexican priest Alberto Atié reacted to the Pope's actions.
Un paso absolutamente nuevo.
This is an unprecedented investigation. The only explanation is that someone with international authority was working to protect and conceal information about these pedophiles. The protection of clerical pedophiles needs to stop.
The Catholic Church has dealt with more than 3,000 cases of sexual abuse worldwide in the past decade. The makers of the popular video game Call of Duty are in a legal tug of war with the former Panamanian dictator. Manuel Noriega, one of Panama's former dictators, filed a lawsuit against Activision, the makers of Call of Duty, this summer. Noriega says that he did not authorize the use of his name or image for the game. Noriega says that Activision portrays him as an enemy of the state, which is damaging his reputation. Activision filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, saying it is frivolous. Activision acquired the legal services of former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, to handle the case. Noriega is serving a prison sentence in Panama after being convicted of drug trafficking, money laundering, and killing political opponents. He served in prison in the U.S. and France before his transfer back to Panama 3 years ago. Noriega is 80 years old. The Cuban government announced that thousands of restaurants will now be privately owned. More than 9,000 state-run restaurants will be transferred to private ownership. Currently, there are less than 2,000 private restaurants on the island. The Cuban government is privatizing in an effort to stimulate the economy. Self-employment became legal in Cuba in 1993. In 2011, the government released a reform plan that made some state-owned businesses, such as barbershops, private. Cuban Research Center President Philip Peters said that the Cuban government is getting out of businesses they have been running badly for the last 50 years. The government will continue to own the land the restaurant sits on, however. In Brazil, researchers released thousands of mosquitoes infected with good bacteria. Researchers in Rio de Janeiro infected thousands of mosquitoes with a bacteria that suppresses dengue fever. The bacteria known as Wolbachia cannot be transmitted directly to humans but can act as a vaccine to mosquitoes carrying dengue fever. 10,000 infected mosquitoes will be released every month for 4 months. The program is taking place in Australia, Vietnam, and Indonesia. For Latin Pulse, I'm Gabriela Canchola. Venezuela.
Thanks, Gabriela. Our shout-out this week goes to our listeners in Venezuela. After our listening groups in Brazil and the United States, our Venezuelan listeners make up the next largest group during the past 3 years. Mil gracias. Now, on to our discussion of unaccompanied migrant children and the crisis they've caused in the past year along the U.S.-Mexico border. This program was among the leaders mentioning this issue last fall. Since then, U.S. authorities have apprehended 66,000 children, some as young as 5 years old, along the border. The U.S. Border Patrol says the worst of the crisis is over. So we spoke to Eric Olson about the situation. Olson is the Associate Director of the Latin America Program of Washington, D.C.'s Wilson Center. We spoke to him on location during his visit to St. Louis's Chase Park Plaza.
Some people blame the Obama administration for not making a clear message to those in Central America that the borders are not open to children, that there was some misinterpretation of the administration's message. Not exactly an amnesty, but an executive order that would set aside repatriation of those who are already here.
Well, these are always very complicated issues, so let me see if I can separate them just a little bit. The first one you mentioned is this perception that, they could get into the United States kind of for free, and that the Obama administration had not handled policy on the border properly. I think one of the misconceptions is that parents are sending their kids from Central America, putting on a bus, saying good luck, you're on your way. Some of that is happening, but a lot of this has to do with family reunification. And these are parents in the United States that know what's going on in those communities, and they know what the children are going to face along the way. So they're not confused about the risks along the way. They're not confused about what it means to try to get into the United States. They're fully aware of that. They're just balancing that with the reality on the ground in their home countries, in Honduras, Salvador, Guatemala, and the risks from their perspective are higher, that their children will be either consumed or brought into gangs, suffer violence of some kind, sexual violence, direct physical violence, be forced into a life of crime, which, any parent is terrified that their child will have to face that. So they're, from their perspective, they're balancing those things and making this very difficult choice. Now, there is an element of what you say that is true. There was a perception that when President Obama declared he was going to slow or defer deportations and not start deporting people, and when people became aware that if children were there, they were given legally what's called a notice to appear before an immigration judge, and that notice was usually a year, year and a half, even up to 2 years down the road, there was a perception that they were getting, quote-unquote, a permiso, a permit to enter into the United States, and that the U.S. was changing its attitudes about children. And the coyotes, the traffickers, did take advantage of that misunderstanding, that, confusion. Obviously, the traffickers themselves were eager to confuse people more because it's money in their pockets. So there was a part of this, an element, that was confusion over what U.S. immigration policy was and what it was becoming that also fed that. But that's not the only thing. I mean, that is not the only criteria under which people decided to go.
So tell us what the other criteria might be.
Well, in general, we talk about four, the one I just mentioned, and I would say that was actually just one element of it. The others have to do with, long-term chronic violence, and we've seen violence in Central America, especially these northern triangle countries, Honduras, Guatemala, Salvador, continuing to tick up. They're now the most violent or at least homicidal countries in the world, the three together. They're three of the top five countries in the world in terms of homicides, and so that's one of the key issues. And Honduras is now the most murderous country in the world. So when you look at the numbers and you see Hondurans are the number one group coming, almost 30% of the children are coming from Honduras, and you see where specifically they're coming from in Honduras, and then you look at the rates of violence, there's little question that violence is another one. A third one, is the economic, social factors, lack of economic opportunity in these countries, poor education, poor access to health. Hondurans in the lower 20% of the economic group of the country reach high school at a rate of under 10%. So very low number of people reaching high school. Even in the top 20% of the population, only 65% are graduating from high school. So you see an education system, you see a situation in which a lot of people really don't see an economic opportunity or possibility for themselves, and so they flee when it's combined with this extreme violence. And then the fourth factor, which actually I think is another really powerful incentive, is this issue of family reunification. They have parents in the U.S. In some cases, they haven't seen their parents in 5, 6, 7, 8 years. There was an expectation that there would be immigration reform in this country and that there would be some way to legally reunite with your family. That seems like it's gone now, that it's not going to happen, at least in the near term. And people got desperate, especially as their children reach that critical age of 12. And if we look at the numbers, the numbers of children arriving who are under the age of 12 continually goes up. Why is that important? Because at the ages of 10, 11, 12 is when they really become targets for gangs in their communities and really being dragged in. So parents really are desperate to make sure that doesn't happen.
Lots to follow up on here, but let's talk specifically, since the last item you mentioned, immigration reform.
Yeah.
And the president had promised that at the end of the spring and has backtracked on that because of domestic politics in the United States. From your statement, you seem to feel like it's possibly dead. There has been some discussion that it might come back after the midterm elections.
Well, the story is that after the election, after he was reelected in 2012, there was a perception that there was a need for both parties to appeal and reach out to the immigrant and Latino community in particular, but also Asians and so on. And so there was a movement towards a bipartisan reform of the immigration system that, by and large, people agree is broken, it's not working well. And so the first step along there was the passage of a bipartisan Senate reform bill, a comprehensive reform bill, that seemed to have many of the elements. Not everybody was happy. Everybody had something to complain about, but it had the elements. The hope was then that the House would take it up. And by late spring, early summer, June, basically, it became evident that that was not going to happen. In other words, legislatively, immigration reform was not an option. And that's when the president said he was going to do everything he could from an executive point of view, without legislation, early in September. Now, as the elections are coming closer and some in the president's party are facing tough re-elections, they've prevailed on him to put that off until after the elections. And might make short-term political sense, but if you're a family member, if you're a citizen and your family is stuck in Central America or any number of countries hoping for some legal vehicle for immigrating to the United States, this is a real blow and a real slap in the face. And the Hispanic community, Latino community in this country is particularly frustrated and upset about it. There's a political logic, but from kind of a humanitarian, human point of view, it's really a tough call.
We did our first program about the unaccompanied minors issue 10 months ago, and other media organizations were doing the same last fall, but this really became the summer story. And I wonder now, are we past the crisis point with this story? Are we starting to see numbers drop, or does it continue to be the same problem that we've seen for the past 9-10 months?
Yeah, that's a really good question, one I don't really have an answer to. The peak of numbers of unaccompanied minors arriving at the border was in June. At 10,600 arrived. They were mostly just turning themselves in to the Border Patrol. They weren't trying to sneak across. They just turned themselves in. And since July, July, the numbers were down by half, little over 5,000. And the numbers we just have gotten now in terms of August are down to 3,200 and something. So there's clearly a strong downward trend. The question you're asking is the right one. Is this a long-term trend? Can we expect the next, you know, month to be at 2,000, 1,000 down? We don't know. There are probably four issues contributing to this downward trend. One is seasonal. These are the hottest months. And traditionally, if you look back at other years, July, August are the lowest in that regard. The second is Mexico is doing a great deal more in terms of enforcement. This was a part of the problem or the dilemma that Mexico traditionally has not viewed this as their problem. This is a U.S. problem from their perspective. They've really begun to change that, done more border enforcement on the Guatemalan border, much more internal enforcement. And we know that Mexico is deporting a lot more people. And then thirdly, I think it's the U.S., you know, trying to communicate to people in Central America that they're not going to be received with open arms, that there's a real risk there. And the fourth thing is some of the changes at the U.S. border, they're being detained longer, processing is happening quicker, and that too is a disincentive. Now, from the other perspective, that may be why they're going down. From the other perspective, none of the underlying causes that I mentioned to you have changed. The economies haven't turned around. The violence continues to be high. All the family reunification is an issue. Absence of immigration reform is that. All those issues are still there. So, on balance, I suspect that this is a seasonal thing. The trafficker is saying, "Wait, let's take a break here. Let's take a breather. There's too much attention to this issue, families knowing it, so on and so forth." But I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see it start going back up. Maybe not reach that June level of 10,600, but certainly I don't think this is done.
Thanks so much. Eric Olson, the Associate Director of the Latin American Program of the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., joining us today on Latin Pulse here in St. Louis. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This planet we call Earth, abundant with new food, new cures, new life. An amazing place. Please don't let it vanish without a trace. Call for your free World Wildlife Fund Action Kit with 10 simple things you can do to help leave our children a living planet. Call 1-800-CALLWWF.
During this trip to Costa Rica, we met with Dr. Ignacio Siles of the Universidad de Costa Rica. Siles is part of a research team comparing the decline of newspapers in the United States, France, and Argentina. He spoke to us about this global issue and how it affects his home country. Again, you may hear busy San Jose in the background as we conducted this interview on location at the university's Communication Research Center, or CECOM.
Costa Rica, in this sense, is very similar to what other places have been experiencing, which is, a decrease of advertising expenditures for newspapers, a decrease of subscribers, a set of people, you know, readers dropping every single day, subscriptions dropping, and a general sense that newspapers don't feel this important social role that they used to feel, that they've been questioned on a number of ways by people who don't trust them the way they used to, or just don't feel the need, especially young readers, to go to newspapers to get a sense of what's going on in their city or their country in order to form an opinion. So that's what is happening in Costa Rica.
Is it that newspapers are just viewed as old media, and that younger people just don't want to pick up this older medium?
Well, there's something about that too, in the sense that people don't tend to relate to the way others, newspapers in particular, present the news to them. But I don't think it's only a matter of the format in which the news are presented to them. I don't think that not necessarily like something on the internet would be more appealing to them. My general sense is that they just don't feel the newspaper gives them, either print or online, gives them anything for them to make their minds.
And notice that you included online
right.
in that analysis. So newspapers are not approaching the online space.
I don't think they're
correctly.
They're doing it for sure, but not necessarily in the best way. I don't think newspaper organizations have been very innovative over the years. I mean, they've struggled to keep up with things that have been going on regarding technology. So they're trying definitely, but I'm not really sure that what they're giving to the people is what the people want. And that's a different problem that is not necessarily based on technology. I think for the most part, and there have been studies about this, people want to read about the things that newspapers don't give them. For example, well, there's an interesting comparative study done by people at Northwestern University where they show how journalists keep insisting on giving them, you know, food for thought, things that would contribute to public sphere, economic news, political news, and you know, things that would be vital for democratic life, and people don't not necessarily want to read that. So what they want to read, there's a huge gap between these two things, is people news about weather, news about crime, news about entertainment, celebrities. So that's the sort of news that they want to read. So news organizations are in a sort of a crossroads. They have to decide what to do. Either insist on giving news that are important for democratic life, but that people not necessarily want to read, or follow the trend and just give them things that aren't necessarily good for, or are not the best thing for democratic life, but that will give them money in return.
The source of your study indicates that this is a global problem, but I would like to talk to you about some of the manifestations of this
right.
in Latin America. So in following on what you just said, one of the things that we've seen certainly in the past generation in Latin America, especially in Latin American newspapers, is La Nota Roja,
right.
sensational news, lots of news about
Correct.
Violence, murders,
Correct.
Lots of
yeah.
bodies on front pages, lots of blood. This hasn't been successful?
To get them readers, I guess it is, but that's not always what newspapers want to promote if they think of themselves as this important source in building democratic life. So they have done that for sure. And for instance, I'm going to give you La Nación's
example. La Nación being the big newspaper,
Costa Rica, big newspaper group in Costa Rica. They own, I would say, about 5 or 6 newspapers, and some of these newspapers have struggled to make some money in return. Others have been relatively surviving. They just created a new newspaper that follows the line of what you just said about the kind of information they want to give. La Nación is also the most influential and most read group in the country. It's a conservative newspaper, and it has been like that for many years. So this new newspaper that they created follows the lines of what you just said. But if they think of themselves as an important force in shaping democratic life, they cannot give you only that. And so that's sort of the crossroads where they are. They have been successful at doing that. So I would say that their most successful newspapers are one about La Nota Roja and one about sports. So that tells you something about... So using the money they get from those newspapers, they sort of fund the rest of their projects. It's not like trying to build a newspaper that gives you important information about public life, public affairs, will give them enough money to survive. I don't think that's the case right now. They just very recently undergone a process of layoffs, and they fired a bunch of journalists, and excellent journalists, people who had been there for many years, who had to find jobs elsewhere, especially people who have been there for many years because they're the most expensive ones for them. So they just fired a bunch of journalists. They changed a building. They integrated print and online because they wanted to cut expenditures. And, you know, instead of having to pay for two buildings or two units, they're now paying for just one. So that's what they have been doing. But I don't think they've been doing a very good job. Or it's a challenge for them on how to be an important force that covers public affairs, that contributes to democratic life in a country like Costa Rica, while also giving what people want to read.
So have we then seen a decrease in the credibility and the quality of La Nación during this change?
Absolutely. You can see changes not only in the kind of news they cover, but also how they cover it. I don't think they have as much resources as they used to have to pay for an editor, someone who would check for mistakes or for fine, you know, typos and that sort of thing. So you can easily find those things in a newspaper now. And for a newspaper of record or a newspaper of reference or a newspaper that likes to think of itself like that, I mean, I think that's inexcusable. They didn't do that in the past. Now they've struggled to do it. You see the headings they use are... You can see that there's not someone behind checking how the news are being put out.
We see similar things happening in other countries in Central America. Certainly, I think of Guatemala right away with La Prensa. But yet the most popular newspaper in Guatemala is one that has lots of sex and violence.
Yes, same here.
And sensational. And so are there other media that are more influential than La Nación now in Costa Rica because of this particular dynamic? Is television the most important medium here, like many other places?
I think newspapers still set the agenda for the rest of the media, and especially La Nación. I think there, you can see it when, you know, the rest of the media follow what La Nación is publishing, and the sort of, there's still a little bit of that dynamic going on, a newspaper, an established newspaper, a newspaper of record, setting the agenda for the rest of the media. I'm not really sure they set the agenda the way they used to do it when it comes to the general public, though I think there are other sources that people are turning to in order to get an idea of what to discuss, especially the internet. You know, you can find more information online or alternative information offline. There have been a couple of experiences with pure players in Costa Rica or organizations that only publish online, but they struggle to find a sustainable economic model that would allow them to cover public affair news. So when they don't have it, they just follow what others are doing, especially newspapers like La Nación.
We've talked on this program before about El Faro in El Salvador, which is a pure player, as you say, an internet publication that's very influential even beyond El Salvador. And so what would be the sources here in Costa Rica, or what would be the sources in Central America that the intelligentsia are turning to as those alternative sources if it's not La Nación?
The intelligentsia, I would say, keeps reading La Nación with a critical eye. Maybe the one I can think that it's doing an interesting job at providing alternative information is El Semanario Universidad, which is a newspaper created at the Universidad de Costa Rica, which has a very long history. They're more critical about the news they produce, and they have funds that come from the university that allows them to precisely go after public affair news, spend time without producing an article, but with the hope that it will produce something in the end. And if it doesn't, well, they still have the funds to, you know, allow a couple of journalists to work on them. They have it experimenting with data journalism. There are a couple of students. It's also a laboratory for students to go there and to interact with established newspaper journalists who have been there for a while. I have to say
ahead.
So the current director of El Seminario Universidad is a journalist who used to work at La Nación, and some of their most important journalists right now is people who was fired by La Nación not too long ago.
So we see this interesting mix happening of journalists who used to work in the newspapers or journalists who used to work in the mainstream media, and maybe some professors of journalism, and students combining to do work. And this is not just a dynamic here in Costa Rica. We see this on a global level. This is an emerging dynamic.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic, especially when you see all the skills that these students bring to the table, their understanding of how to, you know, find data online, how to interact with databases and stuff like that. It's fantastic.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ignacio Siles at the University of Costa Rica, our guest today on Latin Pulse.
Thank you.
That concludes our program this week on location from Costa Rica. If you're looking for earlier editions of Latin Pulse, we're available in various locations on the web, including iTunes, Facebook, and Flipboard. You can also find us in the Brazilian online game, Mini Mundos. If you'd like to comment on this program, you may leave us a message online via SoundCloud, or you may write us via email. You can find us at latinpulse@gmx.com. That's Latin Pulse, all one word, @gmx.com. To see the Latin Pulse archives of video programs on Latin America, you can check out Link TV's website, www.linktv.org, and then /Latin Pulse, also all one word. That's www.linktv.org/LatinPulse. Travel accommodations and support for this trip to Costa Rica were made possible by El Colegio de Periodistas de Costa Rica and the U.S. Embassy in San Jose. Thanks for joining us this week on Latin Pulse. For our entire team, producer Jim Singer and associate producer Gabriela Canchola, I'm Rick Rockwell. Escúchenos otra vez. Gracias por su tiempo.
Latin Pulse is produced at the School of Communications at Webster University, the global university, headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri, with music copyright support from Webster University and through the support of Link TV. This program is copyright 2014 Los Rocas Productions. The preceding program was brought to you with the support of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at American University.